Hi, I'm Raj Mehta, and I'm joined today with Richard Lehman.
Hello, I'm Richard Lehman, and I'm very happy to be talking with Raj. We're quite far apart in age, and so he's going to be asking me questions about what I remember of the origins of EBM and how medicine was 50 years ago when I first entered it.
I think this will be a useful dive. I think there's a lot to discuss about the philosophy of EBM. And I think the history and the origins of it is an important place to start, because knowing the history allows us to appreciate how we got to where we are today in 2022. I think EBM is a topic that's pretty much steeped in every question about medicine today, when talking about drugs or interventions. It's almost a language of how everyday practitioners discuss scientific questions or debate in medicine. And yet, at the same time, I think there's somewhat of a dissatisfaction among many that perhaps EBM is not quite filling the needs of everyday practitioners and doctors, of researchers and journals in general. So I wanted us to start with talking to someone who was practicing medicine before EBM was around. Going back to the maybe 70s, more the 80s and early 90s, what was medicine like for the average doctor? What were the biggest problems regarding science and evidence? And why was medicine that era so ripe for the EBM revolution that occurred?
Yeah, I think that's quite a deep question. I'll start with the end of that. Was medicine ripe for EBM at the end of the 80s? Yes, in retrospect, but in prospect, it was feeling pretty good. It's true that by then, the huge breakthroughs that had occurred just after the war in particular were slightly drying up, but there was plenty going on. And I think if it hadn't been for a group of very smart men, I have to say they were all men at that point, getting together and thinking deeply about the nature of evidence as it was emerging then at the very cutting edge, we probably would have just carried on practicing out of textbooks and going to lectures and being told how it was done by experts and so on. And we'd been quite comfortable with that because that's the way we'd been taught. And for instance, in my lifetime, most of the vaccinations that are now being given to kids were introduced. TB was eradicated more or less in Western countries. Smallpox was totally eradicated. Transplant surgery came in. The hypothesis that smoking caused lung cancer was proved, as far as it's ever been proved, by methodology, which was entirely observational. And so we were pretty smug, and we thought that the innovation pipeline would constantly pour out new goods for us to use. But I think that narrative, which is a sort of heroic narrative that goes back into the mid-19th century, was beginning to look a little bit questionable. And I think that's why they invented this rather provocative term, evidence-based medicine. And even more provocatively, they often contrasted that with eminence-based medicine. So in the old days, you'd listen to somebody a bit if he was a doctor. It was usually a he then. You might listen a little bit more if she was called a professor, and you'd listen extra hard if they had a sir in front of their name in the UK, because that meant that they were the establishment. That was the way it looked in a nutshell. And I think the thing that really changed it were, well, there were several things. First of all, the cost of treatments was rising, so people were demanding better evidence that they worked. Secondly, treatment effects were sizes were becoming less and less, and the awareness of harms was rising. For instance, the use of lidocaine as an antiarrhythmic agent after myocardial infarction killed thousands of patients, but it was the whole raison d'etre for the setting up of coronary care units was to try and combat arrhythmias as soon as they arose. And in fact, that caused a greater mortality in coronary care units than if you left the patient at home. And then the ISIS trials proved that the coronary care units actually had a purpose because you could give them beta blockers and the other treatments that were then introduced, including, of course, thrombolytics, which changed the scene a lot. So we became aware that we needed large trials to detect effect sizes, which were not large, but of massive epidemiological importance and could lead to really quite large reductions in mortality. And similarly with the new drugs for heart failure, which are coming in, the ACE inhibitors were trialed on populations of mostly men with myocardial damage in the 80s, and they were generalized to everybody with reduced systolic ejection fraction. And that's been a matter of debate ever since, but the effect sizes on the face of it seem very good. And at last, we had a treatment for a potentially fatal condition. So that kind of paints a picture of where things were in the 80s.
It sounds like a really thorough review. I really appreciate your points that, you know, in the post-World War era, medicine seemed heroic because, you know, for the first time in history, we were making extraordinary discoveries at extraordinary pace with really large, obvious effect sizes. Perhaps that mentality was appropriate, but as time went on, the changes in the benefits we're seeing were becoming smaller and smaller. And then suddenly, you know, having larger trials and epidemiologic data kind of became necessary to be able to evaluate, observe these things to show that they're really effective.
The third thing I'm interrupting because I promised three things, I think. And the last one was the growth of systematic reviewing. And this was pioneered by Ian Chalmers, who found very significant effects from obstetric interventions, which were by no means clear from individual trials. So it became clear that you could combine studies and use that to prove effects more quickly and more convincingly than you could ever in the past.
And these were some extraordinary things in the 70s, 80s. I mean, that corresponds with the Cochrane Collaborative, which is similarly, you know, lots of multiple small studies, which maybe were inconclusive, and suddenly you combine them, you have a synthesis of evidence making discoveries that previously weren't noticed. What's interesting to me is that I think, you know, historically, the practice of medicine has always been thought of as being empirical, and that empirical nature, if you go back to the, you know, 1700s, 1800s, has been more of a, I think, kind of a deductive approach to reasoning. And I think this transition to EBM and this whole era of medicine is kind of a question of how much of medical reasoning by the average physician is deductive reasoning and how much of it is inductive. Because, you know, you say the 1800s, and certainly there were charlatans and fake practitioners, but then you had, you know, men like Dr. Joseph Bell, who inspired Sir Conan Arthur Doyle and Sherlock Holmes, and, you know, abilities with great analytic skills and intellect and be able to understand things. And certainly in the 1900s, with all these medical revolutions, you have all these new discoveries that were just so obvious you could see it. And a lot of medical practice, certainly standardized training, certification of physicians, but also the way you would make diagnosis, the way you would treat, you know, the evidence was in front of you, what you could see with your eyes. And now it seems like a lot more medicine is not necessarily deductive what every physician sees in front of them, but perhaps, you know, data that we're told from studies and trials and generalizing that and so forth. How do you view that?
Well, if I can pick up on the first point, I think a lot of people get mixed up between deductive and inductive as terms. So perhaps give us an example of what you would call a deductive,
of course,
clinical process.
So I think deductive reasoning, classical philosophy, is when you arrive at a logical conclusion from an assumption. So, you know, mathematics and geometry, classically, you have theorems and postulates, and then you can arrive at a conclusive a result. And whereas inductive is more about inferences. So if I find a penny made of copper, I can make inductive reasoning, say, well, this one penny is made out of copper, then perhaps all pennies are made out of copper. I think the medical application, it's how we approach empirical evidence. So, you know, as a physician, I see something happening and I deduce, oh, this patient responded, they're improving, they didn't respond, they're not improving, as opposed to more of, let's take data from large trials, effects that maybe are not as observable. And now I'm having to think of terms of probabilistic sense, having to think about what's more likely, less likely, and generalizing information that I may have not seen myself.
Okay, so that generalizing process is what you would call deductive, is it, or inductive?
Inductive.
Inductive, yeah. That's roughly the way I understand it. But it's interesting that as we talk about these things, we tend to go slightly in circles, and clearly these terms, although they have a usefulness in their basic meanings, don't fully capture what goes on in our brains as we work as clinicians. However, if I can just go back to what you were saying about the deductive skills of the great John Bell, who inspired Joseph Bell, rather, who inspired Arthur Conan Doyle. He was a great figure. He was in Edinburgh, which had a long tradition of clear thinking and plain speaking. And it happens that the other person in the class, or another person in the class, was somebody called James McKenzie. And he became a GP shortly after and became very dissatisfied with the diagnostic equipment on which he was supposed to base his deductions. And it's all very well saying, you know, when you've proved every other hypothesis is incorrect, then whatever remains must be true. That's one of Sherlock Holmes's famous sayings. He realized that, you know, the hypotheses that you generated in real medicine were pretty elementary, Watson, and just generally fairly rubbish, and that you were going by clinical signs which you might be able to elicit, but the doctor next door wouldn't be able to. And how are you going to make a science out of all this? And he worked in a very busy practice in Lancashire, where people tended to be very poor. They were mostly mill workers, and a lot of them had acquired valvular heart disease, and he became very good at telling the ones who were going to die and the ones who would be okay. But he wanted to go further than that, so he invented a very elaborate device for recording the pulse wave, and this became internationally famous, and he became Sir James McKenzie, and a top cardiologist, the only top cardiologist almost in the UK. And this was on the basis of very careful deduction from the pulse wave, and he more or less worked out the transmission of the electric waves within the heart before anyone had discovered the bundle of His. and he had great conversations with Hiss. Nobody believed that the bundle of Hiss actually existed. And British cardiologists wouldn't believe in it until the great James McKenzie said, yes, this really does exist. And it completely correlates with everything I've discovered about atrial fibrillation and the various irregularities of the pulse that I first observed on these mill workers in Blackburn. And now that he was discovering them in countesses and princes in private practice in London. So he was a great rags to riches story and a great deductive person, but he never mastered the idea that you could do induction from statistical studies, and that was his great blind spot. Anyway, I've digressed there.
No, it's a wonderful story. I think it perfectly captures this. We can use different terms, but the nature of medicine is really about these aspects of keen observation, as you point out, deriving our own conclusions. And that's kind of historically how medicine have been, you know, cases, and the best and brightest of us can pull together ideas with new data, with new ways of making diagnostic observations and pushing the field forward. And it kind of lends itself really to the question I was asking about, which is, you know, this idea of moving medicine from case-based observations that physicians make, that's still a core part of how we train and how we practice, to making inferences from data. And making inferences from data is a very different skill. And part of it actually, I think, raises a very important question that I often think of when I'm working with my physicians or teaching medical students or residents here in the US. It's a very odd question, but I think it's a valuable one. Does the average physician actually understand what modern medicine or modern science is, the modern scientific method? And when I think of someone who understands science, and I think this needs to be in the context of whatever era we're discussing, it's that in your era where you are, if you're using the scientific method, you are able to discern truth from fiction by the data available to you. So 100 years ago, that could be, you know, making observation of the pulse wave and discerning that, yes, the bundle of Hiss and electrophysiology exists. But today, I think telling truth from fiction depends on inferences, statistical inferences, and it's a different type of scientific inquiry and different from this empirical approach. Do you agree with that assessment? And how well would you grade the average physician's ability to evaluate that process?
Well, there are several questions there which arise, and I would say that the average physician, by the law of averages, which we're talking about, is averagely good, and probably, you know, in the words of the famous saying, his results or her results are exactly the results you would expect.
Because average is average, right?
And this is the problem. Let's just go back a few steps and consider the two different models of science that we operate with. We're living in a great scientific age, and examples of that range from particle physics to systems biology, okay? I mean, those are great things and contain enormous complexity. Now, in particle physics, if you detect a particle that shouldn't be there, you rewrite the entire laws of physics. You reinterpret the universe, because you know that your methods are such that if that result can be replicated and keeps coming up, then there has to be something wrong with the existing theory if it's in contravention to it. So there, a theory is a fixed set of ideas that governs the universe, and it has to be a correct description of the universe, or else the whole universe must operate on a different level. And this was demonstrated with Einstein and the perihelion of Mercury, it was out by, I don't know, about 3% or something from the Newtonian calculation. So he saw that as proof that space-time was being warped in a way that had never predicted. Now, if we come to the opposite of that, which is systems biology, we have 30,000 human genes, and yet we have an almost infinite amount of human brain activity and physiology. And that's so those 30,000 genes cannot possibly code for everything that happens in human beings. It's just not on. And in fact, if you start doing the math around it, then you reach numbers that go up to 10 to the power of 211 or something. So if you would compute all the possible interactions that arise from protein synthesis and every other chemical factor in the body, the whole universe would not have enough matter in it to do that. So you're dealing with immense complexity, and the lovely narrative of medicine has been that it can be done like physics. And in some of it can, you know, if you put an electric pulse into a nerve fiber, your arm jumps, or you get a shooting pain or whatever. If you put a certain chemical in a vein, then you pee due to processes of that are known in the renal tubule. If you put insulin in somebody, their sugar drops. If you put glucagon in, it goes back up. And those are nice, easy examples. But what we're doing at the moment is transitioning from the easy stuff to the hard stuff, mm-hmm. where you can only reach statistical approximations. And if something turns out to be in contravention of that, of the statistical likelihoods that you have established, that doesn't change the universe one bit. It simply means that you're dealing with a complex system in which you can't account for everything. It's also why you can't do observational research by multiple adjustments, because you can't adjust for every confounding factor, because you don't know what every confounding factor is. And so you can use the same observational data set to establish one thing, and then find that the next time you look at it, or the next time someone else looks at it, it proves the opposite. And then somebody else does a slightly different observational study, and you're back to square one, you're in a bog. And that's why randomized controlled trials seem to offer a simple way out, because they rule out a lot of the random variation, but they still only tell you what happens to the population that you've done the study in. And I think this is the biggest problem. It's not a matter of lack of statistical ability on the part of physicians. It's because if you're sophisticated enough to understand the statistics, you are sophisticated enough to doubt most of what you read. And most doctors are rightly bothered about doing the best for their patients. And they also are rightly involved with their patients as individuals. And the human brain is only able to do so much work per 10-minute consultation or 20-minute consultation. And a human being is only able to work effectively for maybe up to 10 hours a day. And those times fill up. And we can't expect doctors to be analytic statisticians. That's not what they're selected or trained for. And it's not something that they've got a great deal of time in their practice for.
That's right. So that's right.
I come back to the point, you know, you asked the question, should we be, do they really understand modern science? Well, yes, as far as they need to, for the most part.
Yes.
Can they give you a wonderful statistical critique of a paper in the New England Journal Well, no, but there are other people who can.
Yeah. I think this is a great point, because I think, you know, part of this is that we say we have the skill to do enough to be practitioners to the best of our ability. And I think, if I'm going to make an opinionated comment, I think this is actually something that is a great success of EBM, right? Because some people have said EBM is more like a heuristic rather than a coherent analytic approach. But I think one of the great benefits of this is that it has given this very consensus foundation to the average doc about these are the problems, as you said, with observational studies and confounders and randomized control trials appropriately, you know, allow us to have a magic wand to make discoveries, and that we have a rigorous way to evaluate and validate them, yes. And then the core of the physician's role is understanding, being aware of the synthesis of those data. And then practically, the real difficulty is then figuring out how do we apply it in front of the patient in front of us, because, you know, the trial population and limitations and factors may not exactly externalize or generalize to the patients we're seeing, and there's complications, and, you know, then we have to use a lot more judgment and so forth. But to even be at that point, I think, is a testament to how successful EBM has been in establishing, you know, our thought processes, our expectations of strength of evidence, and how we grade and we judge things.
I think you're absolutely right there. And I often carp at the edges of EBM and point out its shortcomings and so on, but I think we have to recognize that it is a better way of doing things. We're not going to go back towards eminence-based medicine or personal opinion. And if you want to see how the old methods work, read the literature of long COVID as it's coming out, because it's full of mechanism-driven hypotheses that are based on very flimsy evidence, animal experiments, someone trying out this or that dietary supplement, random drugs pulled off the shelf by pharma companies that haven't been able to sell them for anything else and are now doing trials and that sort of thing, and all in small cohorts of people who are desperate to get better. And so there's a huge placebo effect and, yes, very little science. And so, you know, that all that pre-scientific stuff still exists, and it's waiting to pounce all the time. And of course, in acute COVID, we saw that so much with ivermectin and chloroquine and the whole debate, the continuing so-called debate about the effectiveness of vaccines and so forth, and masks, etc. So I think that in terms of fighting to preserve a citadel of decent thinking, honesty, and clarity of scientific vision, good statistics, and so on, EBM is unassailable and needs to be defended, even though I've said it's unassailable. but we need to do better, actually.
Yes.
We're dealing with individual human beings. And I think we're a little bit under nuanced in terms of the way we use the data we've got. And that applies on all sorts of levels. I mean, we don't share it properly with patients. We don't think about it properly ourselves in the context of exactly what they are presenting with. Our diagnostic categories are basically rubbish for the most part, because they cover whole systems and instead of
and that's a great point. I don't think we've touched on that. A lot of the initial EBM movement wasn't just also about the best treatment, is about just helping physicians be better at making diagnoses and being more consistent with that. And that was also a huge challenge. And now just, you know, everyone having a basic idea of, this is sensitivity, specificity, these collection of symptoms make this more probable, and some degree of consensus agreement there is quite a recent thing in our profession, I think.
Yes. And I think we may even have gone backwards in some senses, because in the field of evidence synthesis and so on, there are agreed rules in the in the field of diagnostic definitions, the rules are made up by the eminent still, basically.
So there's a bit of Calvin ball to be.
We will,
this is good because we will have many opportunities going forward to critique and to see visions of the problems and dilemmas that we have with EBM and things that need improvement. But I think it's always good to start with understanding history, context, and celebrating some of the positives and the success. You know, it's worth acknowledging that and to be aware of that, because as we make critiques, as folks, we make suggestions, you don't want to toss a baby with the bathwater. We understand the value of some of the things that are there, consciously keeping them as you think about the gaps in other areas.
Yeah, I think that's a very good standpoint from which to proceed, and it'll be great fun to do that with you. For as long as it takes.
Well, this is the first part, so this is start, so we'll have more. I want to wrap up this first episode with one last question for you, Richard. Do you think EBM was the right phrase for this movement, the right term to use? Were there other terms that you think might have fitted, or do you think that kind of captures what it's all about?
Yes, it's very it's a brilliant question. I think, and no sooner had it been adopted than David Sackett started to drop it. I think for him, it had a shelf life of about 8 years. Gordon Guyatt, I think, first used it in 1992, and Dave Sackett first started abandoning it around 1980. And I think it was a good fighting term. I think it's outlived its usefulness in a sense. And yet there is still this basic truth that if we were to base our medicine on evidence, then that has to be a good thing.
Right.
It has to be such a good thing that it's been criticized for being too much a statement of the obvious. It's like calling your political party the goodness party or something. You know. Well, we're all in favor of goodness. How does your goodness differ from the old goodness? And, you know, doctors, of course, have always used evidence. I think it's also a challenge to look at a wider range of evidence. We've touched on this a little bit. Or to make better use of the evidence that we've collected. And we collect so much evidence on all sorts of things. And yet, if you are sitting with a patient discussing, say, the treatment of urinary tract infection, or what you presume is a urinary tract infection, do you know what the positive predictive value in terms of a successful treatment is, depending on things like the presence of nitrites or indeed of bacteria? You know, do you know the local prevalence of antibiotic resistance so that you can pick the best antibiotic? Are you none of these things come to us through the air, and yet they can. I mean, they can come to us as easily as you in Florida can come to me in Oxfordshire. It can come at the click of a button if the systems were there. And that's only talking about a very minor and local problem. But, you know, if you're talking about decision making and giving advice on major procedures or irrevocable things, then that becomes an absolutely essential ethical part of your health system. The patient must know the benefits and harms of treatment and must know the odds as you can best calculate them for that patient. And all our efforts in hospital medicine, for instance, in surgery, should be focused on that issue, so that shared decision making can become a reality in a fixed situation like that. And if you want to talk about shared decision making in the context of primary care, then you're talking about a much more distributed kind of event where you can chat about it one time, talk about it again another time, try this, try something else. And all the time, you could have that evidence that evidence-based medicine has provided for you in the form of randomized controlled trials and systematic reviews. You can have all that on your screen in front of you, except that nobody gives it to you. They think that you ought to be one of these modern scientific doctors who can collect it all for yourself. Well, why should you? And,
that's right. That's right. I remember, yes, how many of us are doing PubMed searches in between clinical care seeing patients, right?
Precisely.
That's right.
Anyway, on that note, I think I've talked enough. So, yeah.
No, thank you, Richard, for joining us. It's been a wonderful start. I think there's a lot to talk on. And then next episode, I think you've made a good segue because we can discuss a little bit more about the shared decision-making, which is, I think, something been an outgrowth of UBM. One of the great successes of it is finding gaps that UBM hasn't addressed. And perhaps those will be the things that we begin talking about going forward. Good.
But finding them is one thing and filling them is another.
Yes.
And we'll talk about that as well. Okay. Brilliant.
Thank you, Richard.
Okay. Thank you.